Mishima grimaced, a fearsome sight with all those scars crisscrossing his face.
I read there were 400 Damani on each side at Samalaren, and that was a slaughterhouse.
Half the Imperial Army on the field dead, and better than 3 out of 4 among the rebels. Nevertheless, Mishima, we have it to do. Or rather, someone else does. You might escape an apology, but I won't.
What under the light was so upsetting about an apology? The woman smelled resigned.
Unfortunately, it will take weeks, if not months, to gather enough soldiers and money to prick this boil. I thank you for your offer of help, my lord. It will be remembered.
Tylee held out the banner.
You'll want this back, since I can't deliver my side of the bargain. But a piece of advice. The ever-victorious army may have other tasks in front of it for the nonce, but we won't let anyone take momentary advantage of the situation to set himself up as a king. We mean to reclaim this land, not divide it into parcels.
And we mean to keep our lands,
Barilane said fiercely, making her mare lunge across the few paces of dead grass between her and the Shan Chan. The mare was eager to lunge, eager to run, away from that wind, and she had trouble reining the animal in. Even her scent was fierce. No patience now. She smelled like a she-wolf defending her injured mate.
I've heard that your ever-victorious army is misnamed. I've heard the Dragon Reborn defeated you soundly to the south. Don't you ever think that Perenebara can't do the same?
Light, and he had been worried over Aram's hot-headedness.
I don't want to defeat anybody except the Shido, Perrin said firmly, fighting off the image that tried to form in his mind.
He folded his hands in the pommel of his saddle. Stepper seemed to be settling down, at least. The stallion still gave small shivers now and then, but he had stopped rolling his eyes.
There's a way to do that and still keep everything quiet so you don't need to apologize.
If that was important to her, he was ready to use it.
The Daughter of the Nine Moons can rest easy. I told you I had this planned out. Talonvor told me you have some kind of tea that makes a woman who can channel go wobbly in the knees.
After a moment, Tylee lowered the banner back to her saddle and sat studying him.
A woman or a man, she drawled at last. I've heard of several men being caught that way. But just how do you propose feeding it to these 400 women when they're surrounded by 100,000 Aiel?
By feeding it to all of them without letting them know they're drinking it. I'll need as much as I can get, though. Wagon loads, probably. There's no way to heat the water, you see, so it'll be thin tea.
Tylee laughed softly.
A bold plan, my lord. I suppose they might have cartloads at the manufactory, where the tea's made. But that's a long way from here. In Amadisia, almost to Terraban, and the only way I can get more than a few pounds at once would be to tell someone of higher rank why I wanted it. And there's the end of keeping it quiet all over again.
The Ashaman know a thing called traveling, Perrin told her, a way to cross hundreds of miles in a step. And as for getting the tea, maybe this will help.
From his left gauntlet, he pulled a folded, grease-stained piece of paper. Tylee's eyebrows rose as she read it.
Perrin had the short text by heart. The bearer of this stands under my personal protection. In the name of the Empress, may she live forever, give him whatever aid he requires in service to the Empire and speak of it to no one but me.
He had no idea who Sirath Sabel Mildarath was, but if she signed her name to something like that, she had to be important. Maybe she was this Daughter of the Nine Moons. Handing the paper to Mishima, the Banner General stared at Perrin. That sharp, hard scent was back, stronger than ever.
Aes Sedai, Ashaman, Aiel, your eyes, that hammer, now this. Who are you?
Mishima whistled through his teeth.
Sirath herself, he murmured.
I'm a man who wants his wife back, Perrin said. and I'll deal with the Dark One to get her." He avoided looking at the Suldam and Damani. He was not far short of making a deal with the Dark One. "Do we have a bargain?" Tali looked at his outstretched hand, then took it. She had a firm grip. A deal with the Dark One. But he would do whatever it took to get Fael free.
Chapter 5. Something strange. The drumbeat of rain on the tent roof that had lasted through most of the night faded to something softer as Fael approached Savannah's chair, a heavily carved and gilded throne placed in the center of the bright layered carpets that made up the tent's floor, with her eyes carefully lowered to avoid offense. Spring had arrived in a rush, but the braziers were unlit, and the morning air held a touch of chill. Curtsying deeply, she presented the rope-work silver tray. The Aiel woman took the golden goblet of wine and drank without so much as a glance in her direction, but she gave another deep curtsy before backing away and setting the tray down on the brass-bound blue chest that already held a tall-necked silver wine pitcher and three more goblets, then returned to her place with the other 11 Gai Shine present, standing between the mirrored stand lamps along the red silk tent wall. It was a spacious tent, and tall. No low Aiel tent for Savannah. Often it was hard to see her as Aiel at all. This morning she lounged in a red brocaded silk robe, tied so it gaped nearly to her waist and exposed half her considerable bosom, though she wore enough jeweled necklaces, emeralds and firedrops and opals, ropes of fat pearls, that she came near to being decent. The Aiel did not wear rings, yet Savannah had at least one begemmed ring on every finger. The thick band of gold and firedrops worn over the folded blue silk scarf that held back her waist-long yellow hair had taken on the aspect of a coronet, if not a crown. There was nothing Aiel in that. Fael and the others, 6 women and 5 men, had been wakened in the night to stand beside Savannah's bed. A pair of feather mattresses laid one atop the other, in case the woman woke and wanted something. Was any ruler in the world attended by a dozen servants while she slept? She fought the urge to yawn. Many things might earn punishment, but yawning surely would. Gai Shine were supposed to be meek and eager to please, and it seemed that that meant obsequious to the point of groveling. Bane and Chiad, fierce as they were otherwise, seemed to find it easy. Fael did not. In the near month since she was stripped and tied up like a blacksmith's puzzle for hiding a knife, she had been switched 9 times for trivial offenses that were serious in Savannah's eyes. Her last set of welts had not faded completely yet, and she had no intention of earning another set through carelessness. She hoped that Savannah thought her tamed by that night trussed up in the cold. Only Roland and his braziers had saved her life. She hoped that she was not being tamed. Pretend something too long and it could become truth. She had been a prisoner less than 2 months, yet she could no longer recall exactly how many days ago she was captured. At times it seemed she had been in white robes for a year or more. Sometimes the wide belt and collar of flat golden links felt natural. That frightened her. She clung hard to hope. She would escape soon. She had to, before Perrin caught up and tried to rescue her. Why had he not caught up yet? The Shido had been camped at Malden for a long time now. He would not have abandoned her. Her wolf would be coming to rescue her. She had to escape before he got himself killed in the attempt, before she was no longer pretending. "How long are you going to keep punishing Galena Sedai, Tharava?" Savannah demanded, frowning at the Aes Sedai. Tharava was seated cross-legged in front of her on a tasseled blue cushion, straight-backed and stern. "Last night she made my bathwater too hot, and she is so welted I had to order the soles of her feet beaten. That is not very effective when she must be left able to walk." Fael had been avoiding looking at Galena ever since Tharava brought her into the tent, but her eyes went to the woman of their own accord at mention of her name. Galena was kneeling erect, halfway between the 2 Aiel women and slightly to one side, mottled brown bruises on her cheeks, her skin damp and slick from the heavy rain she had been walked through to get there, her feet and ankles muddy. She wore only her fire-drop-studded golden collar and belt, and seemed more naked than naked. Just a stubble remained of her hair and eyebrows. Every hair from head to toe had been singed from her with the one power. Fael had heard it described, along with how the Aes Sedai had been hung from her ankles for her first beating. That had been half the talk among the Gaishine for days. Only the handful who recognized her ageless face for what it was could believe that she was Aes Sedai, and some of those had the same doubts that had plagued Fael on finding an Aes Sedai among the Gaishine. After all, she had the face and the ring, but why would an Aes Sedai let Tharava treat her so? Fael asked herself that question often without arriving at any answer. She kept telling herself that Aes Sedai often did what they did for reasons no one else could understand, but that was not very satisfying. Whatever her reasons for tolerating such abuse, Galena's eyes were wide and frightened now and fixed on Tharava. She was panting so hard that her breasts heaved. She had reason for fear. Anyone passing Tharava's tent was likely to hear Galena howling for mercy inside. For more than half a week, Fael had gotten glimpses of the Aes Sedai on some errand, hairless and garbed as she was now, and running as hard as she could with panic painting her face. And every day Tharava added to the bands of welts that striped Galena from her shoulders to the backs of her knees. Whenever one band began to heal, Tharava refreshed it. Fael had heard Shido mutter that Galena was being treated too harshly, but no one was about to interfere with a wise one. Tharava, nearly as tall as most Aiel men, adjusted her dark shawl in a rattle of gold and ivory bracelets and regarded Galena like a blue-eyed eagle regarding a mouse. Her necklaces, also gold and ivory, seemed plain compared to Savannah's opulence, her dark woolen skirts and white Algoda blouse drab. Yet of the two women, Fael feared Tharava far more than she did Savannah. Savannah might have her punished for a stumble, but Tharava could kill her or crush her for a whim. She surely would for failure. "So long as the faintest bruise remains on her face, the rest of her will be bruised as well. I have left the front of her unmarked so she can be punished for other misdeeds." Galena began trembling. Silent tears leaked down her cheeks. Fael averted her gaze. It was painful to watch. Even if she managed to get the rod from Tharava's tent, could the Aes Sedai any longer be of help in escape? She gave every sign of being completely broken. That was a harsh thought, but a prisoner needed to be practical above all else. Would Galena betray her to try buying her way out of the beatings? She had threatened to betray her if Fael failed to obtain the rod. It was Savannah who would be interested in Perrin Abara's wife, yet Galena looked desperate enough to try anything. Fael prayed for the woman to find strength to hold out. She was still planning an escape on her own, in case the Aes Sedai could not keep her promise to take them with her when she left. But it would be so much easier, so much safer for everyone if she could do it. Oh, light! Why had Perrin not caught up yet? No, she had to keep her focus. "She's not very impressive like that," Savannah muttered, frowning into her goblet now. "Even that ring cannot make her look like an Aes Sedai." She shook her head irritably. For some reason Fael did not understand, it was very important to Savannah that everyone know that Galena was a sister. She had even taken to giving her the honorific. "Why are you here so early, Tharava? I have not even eaten yet. Will you take some wine?" "Water," Tharava said firmly. "As for it being early, the sun is almost over the horizon. I broke fast before it rose. You grow as indolent as a wetlander, Savannah." Lusara, a buxom Domani Gaishine, quickly filled a goblet from the silver water pitcher. Savannah seemed amused by the wise one's insistence on drinking only water, yet she provided it for them. Anything else would have been an insult, even she would want to avoid. The copper-skinned Domani had been a merchant, and well into her middle years, but a few white hairs among the black falling below her shoulders had not been enough to save her. She was stunningly beautiful, and Savannah gathered the rich, the powerful, and the beautiful, simply taking them if they were Gaishine to someone else. There were so many Gaishine that few complained at having one taken. Lusara curtsied gracefully and bowed to present her tray to Tharava on her cushion, all very proper, but on the way back to her place against the wall, she smiled at Fail. Worse, it was a conspiratorial smile. Fail suppressed a sigh. Her last switching had been for a sigh at the wrong moment. Lusara was one of those who had sworn fealty to her in the past 2 weeks. After Aravine, Fail had tried to choose carefully, but rejecting someone who asked to swear was creating a possible betrayer, so she had far too many adherents, a good number of whom she was unsure of. She was beginning to believe that Lusara was trustworthy, or at least that she would not intentionally betray her, but the woman treated their escape plans like a child's game, without cost if they lost. It seemed she had treated merchanting in the same way, making and losing several fortunes, but Fail would have no chance to start over if they lost. Nor would Aleandra, or Megden, or Lusara. Among Savannah's Guy Shine, those who actually attempted escape were kept chained when not serving her or performing tasks. Thurava took a swallow of water, then set the goblet down on the flowered carpet beside her and fixed Savannah with a steely gaze. The wise ones believe it is past time for us to move north and east. We can find easily defended valleys in the mountains there, and we can reach them in less than 2 weeks, even slowed as we are by the Guy Shine. This place is open on every side, and our raids to find food must go further and further. Savannah's green eyes met that stare without blinking, which Fail doubted she herself could have done. It nettled Savannah when the other wise ones met without her, and frequently she took it out on her Guy Shine, but she smiled and took a sip of wine before replying in patient tones, as though explaining to someone not quite bright enough to understand. Here, there is good soil for planting, and we have their seed to add to our own. Who knows what the soil is like in the mountains? Our raids bring in cattle and sheep and goats, too. Here there are good pastures. What pasturage do you know of in these mountains, Thurava? Here we have more water than any clan has ever had. Do you know where the water is in the mountains? As to defending ourselves, who will come against us? These wetlanders run from our spears. Not all run, Thurava said dryly. Some are even good at dancing the spears. And what if Randall Thor sends one of the other clans against us? We would never know until the horns closed in on us. Suddenly she smiled too, a smile that never reached her eyes. Some say your plan is to be captured and made Guy Shine to Randall Thor so you can induce him to marry you. An amusing idea. You agree? Despite herself, Fail flinched. Savannah's mad intention to marry Althor, she had to be mad to think she could, was what put Fail in danger from Galena. If the Aiel woman did not know that Perrin was linked to Althor, Galena could tell her. Would tell her if she could not get her hands on that cursed rod. Savannah would take no chances on losing her then. She would be chained as certainly as if caught trying to escape. Savannah looked anything except amused. Eyes glittering, she leaned forward, her robe gaping to expose her bosom completely. Who says this? Who? Thurava picked up her goblet and took another swallow of water. Realizing she would get no answer, Savannah leaned back and rearranged her robe. Her eyes still glittered like polished emeralds, though, and there was nothing casual in her words. They came out as hard as her eyes. I will marry Randall Thor, Thurava. I almost had him, until you and the other wise ones failed me. I will marry him, unite the clans, and conquer all of the wetlands. Thurava sneered over her goblet. Kuladin was the Karakarn, Savannah. I have not found the wise ones who gave him permission to go to Ruidion, but I will. Randall Thor is a creature of the Aes Sedai. They told him what to say at Al-Kher Dal, and a black day it was when he revealed secrets few are strong enough to know. Be grateful that most believe he lied, but I forget. You have never gone to Ruidion. You believed his lies yourself. Guy Shine began entering past the tent flap, their white robes rain damp, holding their hems knee-high until they were inside. Each wore the golden collar and belt. Their soft white-laced boots left muddy marks on the carpets. Later, when those had dried, they would have to clean them away, but getting visible mud on your robes was a sure path to the switch. Savannah wanted her guy shine spotless when they were around her. Neither Aiel woman paid the slightest attention to the arrivals. Savannah seemed taken aback by what Tharava had said. "Why do you care who gave Kuladin permission?" "No matter," she said, waving a hand as though brushing away a fly when she got no reply. "Kuladin is dead. Randall Thor has the markings, however he got them. I will marry him and I will make use of him. If the Aes Sedai could control him and I saw them handling him like a babe, then I can. With a little help from you. And you will help. You agree that uniting the clans is worth doing no matter how it is done? You did once." Somehow there was more than a hint of threat in that. "We Shido will become the most powerful of the clans in one leap." Lowering their cowls, the new Gaishine filed wordlessly along the tent walls, 9 men and 3 women, one of them Megdin. The sun-haired woman wore a grim expression that had been on her face since the day Tharava had discovered her in the Wise One's tent. Whatever Tharava had done, all Megdin would say of it was that she wanted to kill the other woman. Sometimes she whimpered in her sleep, though. Tharava kept whatever she thought about uniting the clans to herself. "There is much feeling against staying here. Many of the Sept chiefs press the red disc on their Narbaha every morning. I advise you to heed the wise ones." Narbaha? That would mean Box of Fools, or something very near. But what could this be? Bane and Chiad were still teaching her about Aiel ways when they could find time, and they had never mentioned any such thing. Megdin stopped beside Lusara. A slender Kyrianan nobleman named Dormanes stopped beside Fael. He was young and very pretty, but he bit his lip nervously. If he learned about the oaths of fealty, he would have to be killed. She was certain he would run to Savannah in a heartbeat. "We remain here," Savannah said angrily, flinging her goblet to the carpets in a spray of wine. "I speak for the clan chief, and I have spoken."
"You have spoken," Tharava agreed calmly. "Benduin, Sept Chief of the Green Salts, has received permission to go to Ruidion. He left 5 days ago with 20 of his Algae de Siswai and 4 wise ones to stand witness."
Not until one of the new Gaishine stood beside each of those already there did Fael and the others raise their cowls and begin filing along the walls toward the door flap, already gathering their robes to the knee. She had become quite sanguine about exposing her legs so.
"He seeks to replace me? And I was not even informed?"
"Not you, Savannah. Kuladin. As his widow, you speak for the clan chief until a new chief returns from Ruidion, but you are not the clan chief."
Fael stepped out into the cold, gray morning drizzle, and the tent flap cut off whatever Savannah said to that. What was going on between the two women? Sometimes, as this morning, they seemed antagonists, but at others they seemed reluctant conspirators bound together by something that gave neither any comfort. Or perhaps it was the being bound together itself that made them uncomfortable. Well, she could not see how knowing would help her escape, so it did not really matter. But the puzzle nagged at her. 6 maidens stood clustered in front of the tent, veils hanging down onto their chests, spears thrust up through the harness of the bow cases on their backs. Bane and Chiad were contemptuous of Savannah for using Maidens of the Spear for her guard of honor, though she herself had never been a maiden, and for having her tent always guarded. But there were never fewer than 6, night or day. Those two were contemptuous of the Shido maidens for allowing it, too. Neither being a clan chief nor speaking for one gave you as much power as most nobles possessed. These maidens' hands were flashing in a rapid conversation. She caught the sign for Karakarn several times, but not sufficient else to make out what they were saying, or whether about Al-Thor or Kuladin. Standing there long enough to find out, if she could find out, was beyond the question. With the others already hurrying away down the muddy street, the maidens would become suspicious for one thing, and then they might switch her themselves, or worse, use her own bootlaces. She had had a hard dose of that from some maidens for having insolent eyes, and she did not want another, especially when it meant bearing herself in public.
Being Savannah's Gaishine gave no protection. Any Shido could discipline any Gaishine they thought was behaving improperly. Even a child could, if the child was set to watch you carry out a chore. For another thing, the cold rain, light as it was going to soak through her woolen robes soon enough. She had only a short walk back to her tent, no more than a quarter of a mile, but she would not complete it without being stopped for a time. A yawn cracked her jaws. She turned from the large red tent. She very much wanted her blankets and a few more hours' sleep. There would be more chores come afternoon. What they might be, she did not know. Matters would be much simpler if Savannah settled on who she wanted to do what when, but she seemed to choose names at random and always at the last minute. It made planning anything, much less the escape, very difficult. All sorts of tents surrounded Savannah's. Low, dark Aiel tents, peaked tents, walled tents, tents of every sort and size in every color imaginable, separated by a tangle of dirt streets that were now rivers of mud. Lacking enough of their own, the Shido snatched up every tent they could find. 14 septs were camped in a sprawl around Malden now, 100,000 Shido and as many Gaishine, and rumor said 2 more septs, the Morai and the White Cliff, would arrive within days. Aside from small children splashing through the mud with romping dogs, most of the people she could see as she walked wore mud-stained white and were carrying baskets or bulging sacks. Most of the women did not hurry. They ran. Except for the blacksmiths, the Shido seldom did any work themselves, and generally only out of boredom, she suspected. With so many Gaishine, finding chores for them all was itself a chore. Savannah was no longer the only Shido to actually sit in a bathtub with a Gaishine scrubbing her back. None of the wise ones had gone that far yet, but some of the others would not stir themselves 2 paces to pick something up when they could tell a Gaishine to fetch it. She was almost to the Gaishine portion of the camp, hard against the grey stone walls of Malden, when she saw a wise one striding toward her with her dark shawl wrapped around her head against the rain. Fael did not stop, but she bent her knees a little. Mera was not so frightening as Thurava, but the grim-faced woman was hard enough and shorter than Fael. Her narrow mouth always grew even tighter when she was confronted with a woman taller than she. Fael would have thought that learning her own sept, the White Cliff, would be there soon, would brighten the woman's mood, but the news had had no discernible effect at all. "So you were just lagging," Mera said as she came close. Her eyes were as hard as the sapphires they resembled. "I left Riala listening to the others because I feared some drunken fool had pulled you into a tent." She glared around her as though looking for a drunken fool about to do just that. "No one accosted me, wise one," Fael said quickly. Several had in the last few weeks, some drunk and some not, but Rolan always appeared in the nick of time. Twice the big Meridin had had to fight to save her, and once he had killed the other man. She had expected 9 kinds of uproar and trouble, but the wise ones judged it a fair fight, and Rolan said her name had never been mentioned. For all that Bane and Chiad insisted it went against all custom, assault was a constant danger for Gaishine women here. She was sure that Alejandra had been assaulted once, before she and Megdin also acquired Meridin shadows. Rolan denied having asked them to help her people. He said they were just bored and looking for something to do. "I'm very sorry I was slow." "Do not cringe. I'm not Thurava. I will not beat you for the pleasure of it." Words said in tones hard enough for a headsman. Mera might not beat people for pleasure, but Fael knew for a fact that she had a strong arm swinging a switch. "Now tell me what Savannah said and did. This water falling from the sky may be a wondrous thing, but it is miserable to walk around in." Obeying the command was easy. Savannah had not wakened during the night, and once she did rise, all her talk had been of what clothes and jewels she would wear, especially the jewels. Her jewelry chest had been made to hold clothing, and it was filled to the top with more gems than most queens possessed. Before putting on any garment at all, Savannah had spent time trying on different combinations of necklaces and rings and studying herself in the gilt-framed stand mirror. It had been very embarrassing for Fael.
She had just reached Thurava's arrival with Galena when everything in front of her eyes rippled. She rippled. It was not imagination. Mera's blue eyes widened as far as they could go. She had felt it too. Again everything rippled, including herself, harder than before. In shock, Fael stood up straight and let go of her robe. A third time the world rippled harder still, and as it passed through her she felt as if she might blow away in a breeze or simply dissipate in a mist. Breathing hard, she waited for the fourth ripple, the one she knew would destroy her and everything else. When it did not come, she expelled every bit of air in her lungs from relief. "What just happened, Wise One? What was that?" Mera touched her own arm and looked faintly surprised that her hand did not pass through flesh and bone.
"I do not know," she said slowly.
Giving herself a shake, she added, "Go on about your business, girl." She gathered her skirts and strode past Fael at little short of a trot, splashing mud as she went. The children had vanished from the street, but Fael could hear them wailing inside the tents. Abandoned dogs shivered and whined, tails tucked between their legs. People in the street were touching themselves, touching each other, Shido and Guy Shine alike. Fael clasped her hands together. Of course she was solid. She had only felt as though she were turning to mist. Of course. Hoisting her robes to avoid any more washing than she absolutely had to do, she began to walk, and then to run, careless of how much mud she splashed onto herself or anyone else. She knew there could be no running from another of those ripples, but she ran anyway, as fast as her legs could carry her. The Gaishine tents made a broad ring around Malden's high granite walls, and they were as varied as the tents in the outer part of the encampment, though most were small. Her own peaked tent could have slept, too, uncomfortably. It housed herself and three others, Aleandra, Megdin, and a former Kyrian noblewoman named Dyraine, one of those who curried favor with Savannah by carrying tales about the other Gaishine. That complicated matters, but there was no mending it short of killing the woman, and Fael would not countenance that. Not unless Dyraine became a real threat. They slept huddled together like puppies of necessity, glad of the shared body warmth on cold nights. The interior of the low tent was dim when she ducked inside. Lamp oil and candles were in short supply and not wasted on Gaishine. Only Aleandra was there, lying face down on her blankets in her collar with a damp cloth dipped in an herbal infusion over her bruised bottom. At least the wise ones were as willing to give their healing herbs to Gaishine as to Shido. Aleandra had done nothing wrong, but had been named as one of the five who had pleased Savannah least yesterday. Unlike some, she had done quite well while being punished. Dormanas had begun weeping even before he was bent over the chest, but she seemed to be among those chosen out every 3 or 4 days. Being a queen did not teach you how to serve a queen. But then Megden was picked nearly as often, and she was a lady's maid, if not a very skilled one. Fael herself had only been chosen once. It was a measure of how Aleandra's spirits had fallen that she made no move to cover herself, only raised up on her elbows. Still, she had combed her long hair. If she failed to do that, Fael would know the woman had reached bottom.
"Did anything strange happen to you just now, my lady?" she asked, fear strong in her unsteady voice.
"It did," Fael said, standing crouched under the ridgepole. "I don't know what it was. Mera doesn't know what it was. I doubt any of the wise ones do. But it didn't harm us." "Of course it had not harmed them. Of course not. And it changes nothing in our plans." Yawning, she unfastened the wide golden belt and dropped it on her blankets, then grasped her outer robe to pull it over her head. Aleandra put her head down on her hands and began weeping quietly.
"We'll never escape. I'm going to be beaten again tonight. I know it. I'm going to be beaten every day for the rest of my life."
With a sigh, Fael left her outer robe where it was and knelt to stroke her liegewoman's hair.
there were as many responsibilities down as up. I have those same fears now and then, she admitted softly, but I refuse to let them take control. I will escape. We will escape. You have to keep your courage, Alejandra. I know you're brave. I know you've dealt with Massima and kept your nerve. You can keep it now if you try. Aravine put her head in at the tent flap. She was a plain, plump woman, a noble, Fail was sure, though she never claimed it, and despite the dimness, Fail could see that she was beaming. She wore Savannah's belt and collar, too. My lady, Alvon and his son have something for you. It will have to wait a few minutes, Fail said. Alejandra had stopped crying, but she was just lying there, silent and still. My lady, you won't want to wait for this. Fail's breath caught. Could it be possible? It seemed too much to hope for. I can keep my nerve, Alejandra said, raising her head to gaze at Aravine. If what Alvon has is what I hope it is, I'll keep my nerve if Savannah has me put to the question. Snatching up her belt, being seen outside without belt and collar both, meant punishment almost as severe as for trying to run away, Fail hurried out of the tent. The drizzle had slackened to a misting rain, but she pulled up her cowl anyway. The rain was still cold. Alvon was a stocky man, overtopped by his son Theril, a lanky boy. Both wore mud-stained, almost white robes made of tent cloth. Theril, Alvon's eldest, was only 14, but the Shido had not believed it because of his height, as much as most men in Amadicia. Fail had been ready to trust Alvon from the start. He and his son were something of legends among the Gaishine. 3 times they had run away, and each time it had taken the Shido longer to bring them back. And despite increasingly fierce punishment, on the day they swore fealty, they had been planning a 4th attempt to return to the rest of their family. Neither ever smiled that Fail had seen, but today smiles wreathed Alvon's weathered face and Theril's skinny one alike. What do you have for me? Fail asked, hastily fastening her belt around her waist. She thought her heart was going to pound its way out of her chest.
It was my Theril, my lady, Alvon said.
A woodcutter, he spoke with a coarse accent that made him barely intelligible.
He was just walking by, see, and there was nobody around, nobody at all, so he ducked in quick-like and show the lady, Theril.
Shyly, Theril reached into his wide sleeve, the robes usually had pockets sewn in there, and drew out a smooth white rod that looked like ivory, about 1 foot long and as slim as her wrist. Looking around to see if anyone was watching, the street was empty save for them, for the moment at least. Fail took it quickly and pushed it up her own sleeve to tuck into the pocket there. The pocket was just deep enough to keep it from falling out, but now that she had the thing in hand, she did not want to let go of it. It felt like glass and was distinctly cool to the touch, cooler than the morning air. Perhaps it was an Angrial or a Turangrial. That would explain why Galena wanted it, if not why she had not taken it herself. Hand buried in her sleeve, Fail gripped the rod hard. Galena was no longer a threat. Now she was salvation. You understand, Alvon, that Galena may be unable to take you and your son with her when she leaves, she said. She has only promised that to me and those captured with me. But I promise you that I will find a way to free you and everyone who has sworn to me. All the rest, too, if I can, but those above all. Under the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth, I swear it. How, she had no idea, short of calling on her father for an army, but she would do it. The woodcutter made as if to spit, then glanced at her, and his face colored. He swallowed instead.
That Galena ain't going to help nobody, m'lady. Says she's Aes Sedai and all, but she's that Thrava's plaything, if you ask me. And that Thrava ain't never going to let her go. Anyways, I know if we can get you free, you'll come back for the rest of us. No need for you to swear and all that. You said you wanted the rod if anybody could lay hands on it without getting caught, and Theril got it for you, that's all. I want to be free, Theril said suddenly. But if we get anybody free, then we've beaten them.
He looked surprised that he had spoken, and blushed deep red.
His father frowned at him, then nodded thoughtfully. "Very well said," Fail told the boy gently. "But I made my oath, and I stand by it. You and your father..." She cut off as Aravine, looking past her shoulder, laid a hand on her arm. The woman's smile had been replaced by fright. Turning her head, Fail saw Roland standing beside her tent. A good 2 hands taller than Perrin, he wore his shufa coiled around his neck, with the black veil hanging down his broad chest. Rain slicked his face and made his short red hair cling to his scalp in curls. How long had he been there? Not long, or Aravine would have noticed him before. The tiny tent offered little concealment. Alvon and his son had their shoulders hunched, as if they were thinking about attacking the tall Meridin. That was a very bad idea. Mice attacking a cat was not in it, as Perrin would have said. "Go on about your duties, Alvon," she said quickly. "You too, Aravine. Go on now." Aravine and Alvon had sense enough not to offer courtesies before leaving with final worried glances at Roland, but Theral half raised a hand toward knuckling his forehead before catching himself. Blushing, he scurried away after his father. Roland came out from beside the tent to stand in front of her. Oddly, he had a small bunch of blue and yellow wildflowers in one hand. She was very conscious of the rod she was holding in her sleeve. Where was she to hide it? Once the Rava discovered it missing, she likely would turn the camp upside down.
"You must be careful, Fail Bashir," Roland said, smiling down at her.
Aleandra called him not quite pretty, but Fail had decided she was wrong. Those blue eyes and that smile made him very nearly beautiful.
"What you are about is dangerous, and I may not be here to protect you much longer."
"Dangerous?" She felt a chill in her middle. "What do you mean? Where are you going?" The thought of losing his protection made her stomach lurch. Few of the Wetlander women had escaped the attentions of Shido men. Without him...
"Some of us are thinking of returning to the Threefold Land."
His smile faded.
"We cannot follow a false Karakarn, and a Wetlander at that. But perhaps we will be allowed to live out our lives in our own holds. We think on it. We have been a long time from home, and these Shido sicken us."
She would find a way to deal with it once he was gone. She would have to, somehow. "And what am I doing that is dangerous?" She tried to make her voice light, but it was difficult. Light. What would happen to her without him?
"These Shido are blind even when they are not drunk, Fail Bashir," he replied calmly.
Pushing her cowl back, he tucked one of the wildflowers into her hair above her left ear.
"We, Meridin, use our eyes."
Another wildflower went into her hair on the other side.
"You have made many new friends lately, and you are planning to escape with them. A bold plan, but dangerous."
"And will you tell the wise ones, or Savannah?" She was startled when that came out in an even tone. Her stomach was trying to tie itself into knots.
"Why would I do that?" he asked,
adding another flower to her decorations.
"Jorodin thinks he will take Lasiel Aldorwin back to the Threefold Land with him, even if she is a tree killer. He believes he may convince her to make a bridal wreath to lay at his feet."
Lasiel had found her own protector by climbing into the blankets of the Meridin who had made her Gaishine, and Arla had done the same with one of the maidens who had captured her, but Fail doubted that Jorodin would attain his wish. Both women were focused on escape like arrows aimed at a target.
"And now that I think on it, I may take you with me if we go."
Fail stared up at him. The rain was beginning to soak through her hair. "To the waist? Roland, I love my husband. I've told you that, and it is true."
"I know," he said, continuing to add flowers. "But for the moment you still wear white, and what happens while you wear white is forgotten when you put it off. Your husband cannot hold it against you. Besides, if we go, when we come near a Wetlander town, I will let you go. I should never have made you Gaishine in the first place.
That collar and belt hold enough gold to get you safely back to your husband." Her mouth fell open in shock. It surprised her when her fist struck his wide chest. Guy Shine were never allowed to offer violence, but the man just grinned at her. "You!" She struck him again, harder. She beat at him. "You! I can't think of a word bad enough! You let me think you were going to abandon me to these Shido while all along you were meaning to help me escape?" Finally, he caught her fist and held it easily with a hand that enveloped hers completely. "If we go, Fail Bashir," he laughed. The man laughed! "It is not decided. Anyway, a man cannot let a woman think he is too eager." Again, she surprised herself, this time by beginning to laugh and cry at the same time, so hard that she had to lean against him or fall down. That bloody Aiel sense of humor! "You are very beautiful with flowers in your hair, Fail Bashir," he murmured, tucking in another blossom. "Or without them. And for the moment, you still wear white."
Light.
She had the rod, leaning against her arm so coolly, but there was no way to give it to Galina until Tharava let her walk around freely again. No way to be sure that the woman would not betray her before then out of desperation. Roland offered her escape, if the Meridan decided to leave, but he would continue to try to inveigle her into his blanket so long as she wore white. And if the Meridan decided not to go, would one of them betray her escape plans? If Roland could be believed, they all knew. Hope and danger all tied together inextricably. What a tangle. She turned out to have been exactly right about Tharava's reaction. Just before midday, all of the Gaishine were herded into the open and made to strip to their skins. Covering herself as best she could with her hands, Fail huddled together with other women wearing Savannah's belt and collar. They had been made to put those on again straight away, huddled for a scrap of decency while Shido rummaged through the Gaishine tents, tossing everything out into the mud. All Fail could do was think about her hiding place inside the town and pray. Hope and danger, and no way to untangle them.
Chapter 6. A Stave and a Razor. Matt had never really expected Luca to leave Jurador after only one day. The stone-walled salt town was wealthy, and Luca did like to see coin stick to his hands. So he was not exactly disappointed when the man told him that Valen Luca's grand traveling show and magnificent display of marvels and wonders would remain there at least two more days. Not exactly disappointed, yet he had hoped that his luck might hold good or his being Taviran. But then, being Taviran had never brought anything other than bad that he could see.
"The lines at the entrance are already as long as they were at their best yesterday,"
Luca said, gesturing expansively. They were inside Luca's huge, gaudy wagon early on the morning after Rena's death, and the tall man sat in the gilded chair at the narrow table, a real table with stools tucked under for guests. Most other wagons had an affair rigged on ropes from the ceiling, and people sat on the beds to eat. Luca had not yet donned one of his flamboyant coats, but he made up for it with gestures. Littell, his wife, was cooking the breakfast porridge on a small iron-topped brick stove built into a corner of the windowless wagon, and the air was sharp with spices. The harsh-faced woman put so many spices into everything she prepared that it was all inedible in Matt's estimation, yet Luca always gobbled down whatever she set in front of him, as if it were a feast. He must have a leather tongue.
"I expect twice as many visitors today, maybe three times as many, and tomorrow as well. People can't see everything in one visit, and here they can afford to come twice. Word of mouth, Cawthon, word of mouth. That brings as many as Aludra's night flowers.
I feel almost like Taviran, the way things are falling out. Large audiences and the prospect of more. A warrant of protection from the High Lady."
Luca cut off abruptly, looking faintly embarrassed, as if he had just remembered that Matt's name was on that warrant as being excluded from protection.
"You might not like it if you really were Taviran," Matt muttered, which made the other man give him an odd look.
He put a finger behind the black silk scarf that hid his hanging scar and tugged at it. For a moment, the thing had felt too tight. He had spent a night of bleak dreams about corpses floating downstream and woken to the dice spinning in his head, always a bad sign, and now they seemed to be bouncing off the inside of his skull harder than before. "I can pay you as much as you'll make for every show you give between here and Lugard, no matter how many people attend. That's on top of what I promised for carrying us to Lugard." If the show was not stopping all the time, they could cut the time to reach Lugard by 3/4 at the least. More if he could convince Luca to spend whole days on the road instead of half days the way they did now. Luca seemed taken with the idea, nodding thoughtfully, but then he shook his head with a sadness that was plainly feigned and spread his hands.
"And what will that look like? A traveling show that never stops to give shows? It will look suspicious, that's what. I have the warrant, and the High Lady will speak up for me besides. But you certainly don't want to pull the Shonchan down on us. No, it's safer for us this way."
The man was not thinking of Matt Cawthon's bloody safety. He was thinking that his bloody shows might earn him more than Matt paid. That, plus making himself as much the center of attention as any of the performers, was nearly as important to him as gold. Some of the show folk talked of what they would do when they retired. Not Luca. He intended to keep on until he fell over dead in the middle of a show, and he would arrange it so he had the largest audience possible when he did.
"It's ready, Valen," Littell said affectionately as she lifted the iron pot from the stove with a cloth protecting her hands and set it down on a thick woven mat on the table. Two places had already been set, with white glazed plates and silver spoons. Luca would have silver spoons when everyone else settled for tin or pot metal or even horn or wood. Stern-eyed, with a hard set to her mouth, the bear trainer looked quite odd wearing a long white apron over her spangled blue dress. Her bears probably wished they had trees to climb when she frowned at them. Strangely, though, she jumped to ensure her husband's comforts.
"Will you be eating with us, Master Cawthon?"
There was no welcome in that. In fact, just the opposite, and she showed no sign of turning to the cupboard where the plates were stored. Matt gave her a bow that soured her face further. He had never been less than civil to the woman, but she refused to like him.
"I thank you for the kind invitation, Mistress Luca, but no."
She grunted. So much for being courteous. He put on his flat-brimmed hat and left, the dice rattling away. Luca's big wagon, glittering in red and blue and covered with golden stars and comets, not to mention the phases of the moon in silver, stood in the middle of the show, as far as possible from the animals' smelly cages and the horse lines. It was surrounded by smaller wagons, little houses on wheels, most windowless and most painted just a single color with none of Luca's extra decorations, and by wall tents, the size of small houses in blue or green or red, sometimes striped. The sun stood nearly its own height above the horizon in a sky where a sprinkling of white clouds drifted slowly, and children ran playing with hoops and balls, while the show folk were limbering up for their morning performances, men and women twisting and stretching, many with glittering, colorful spangles on their coats or dresses. Four contortionists, in filmy trousers tied at the ankle and blouses thin enough to leave little to the imagination, made him wince. Two were sitting on their own heads atop blankets spread on the ground beside their red tent, while the others had twisted themselves into a pair of knots that looked beyond untying. Their backbones must have been made of spring wire. Petra, the strong man, stood bare-chested beside the green wagon he shared with his wife, warming up by lifting weights with either hand that Matt was not sure he could have lifted with both. The man had arms thicker than Matt's legs, and he was not sweating at all. Clarine's dogs stood in a line at the steps of the wagon, wagging their tails and eagerly waiting on their trainer. Unlike Littell's bears, Matt figured the plump woman's dogs performed so they could make her smile. He was always tempted to just sit quietly somewhere when the dice were clicking in his head, someplace nothing seemed likely to happen, waiting for the dice to stop, and though he would have enjoyed watching some of the female acrobats, a number of whom were as little as the contortionists, he set out to walk the half-mile to Jurador, eyeing everyone on the wide, hard-packed clay road closely. There was a purchase he hoped to make. People were coming to join the long line waiting behind a stout rope, stretched along the show's tall canvas wall,
only a handful with more than a touch of embroidery on the women's dresses or the men's short coats, and a few farmers' high-wheeled carts lumbering behind a horse or an ox. Figures moved among the small forest of windmills that pumped the salt wells in the low hills behind the town, and around the long evaporation pans. A merchant's train of canvas-covered wagons, 20 of them behind 6-horse teams, rumbled out of the town gates as he approached, the merchant herself in a bright green cloak seated beside the driver of the first wagon. A flock of crows cawed past overhead, giving him a chill, but no one vanished before his eyes, and everybody cast a long shadow so far as he could make out. There were no dead people's shades walking the road today, although he was convinced that was what he had seen the day before. The dead walking surely could mean nothing good. Very likely it had something to do with Tarmangaiden and Rand. Colors whirled in his brain, and for an instant in his head, he saw Rand and Min standing beside a large bed, kissing. He stumbled and nearly tripped over his own boots. They had not been wearing any clothes. He would have to be careful thinking about Rand. The colors swirled and resolved for a moment, and he stumbled again. There were worse things to spy on than kissing. Very careful, what he thought. Light. The pair of guards leaning on their halberds at the iron-studded gates, hard-faced men in white breastplates and conical white helmets with horsetail crests, eyed him suspiciously. They probably thought he was drunk. A reassuring nod failed to change their expressions by a hair. He could have used a stiff drink right then. The guards did not try to stop him entering, though, just watched him pass. Drunks caused trouble, especially a man who was drunk this early in the day. But a drunk in a good coat, plain but well-cut and good silk, a man with a little lace at his wrists, was an altogether different matter. The stone-paved streets of Jurador were noisy even at this hour, with hawkers carrying trays or standing behind barrows crying their wares, and shopkeepers beside narrow tables in front of their shops bellowing the fineness of their goods, and coopers hammering hoops onto barrels for shipping salt. The clatter of rugmakers' looms nearly drowned out the ringing of the occasional blacksmith's hammer, not to mention the music of flutes and drums and dulcimers drifting from inns and taverns. It was a jumble of a town with shops and houses and inns, cheek by jowl with taverns and stables, all of stone and roofed with reddish tiles. A solid town, Jurador, and one accustomed to thievery. Most windows on the lower floors were covered with stout screens of wrought iron. The upper windows as well on the homes of the wealthy, most of whom were no doubt salt merchants. The music of the inns and taverns pulled at him. Likely there would be dice games going on in most of them. He could almost feel those dice spinning across a table. It had been too long since he had rattled a set of dice in his hands instead of inside his head, but he was not there for gambling this morning. He had had no breakfast yet, so he approached a wrinkled woman with a tray hung from a strap around her neck who shouted, "Meat pies made from the finest beef to be found in Altara." He took her word for it and handed over the coppers she demanded. He had seen no cattle at any farms near Jurador, only sheep and goats, but it was best not to inquire too closely what was in a pie bought in the streets of any town. There could be cows on nearby farms. There could be. In any case, the meat pie was tasty and still hot for a wonder, and he walked on along the crowded street, juggling the pie and wiping greasy juice from his chin. He was careful not to bump into anyone in the throng. Altarans were a touchy lot, by and large. In this town, you could tell somebody's station to within a whisker by the amount of embroidery on coat or dress or cloak, the more the higher, long before you were close enough to tell wool from silk. Though the richer women covered their olive-skinned faces with transparent veils hung from ornate combs stuck into their tightly coiled braids. But men and women alike, whether salt merchants or ribbon hawkers, wore long belt knives with curved blades and sometimes fondled the hilts as though looking for a fight. He always tried to avoid fighting, though his luck seldom did him much good there. Taviran took over with that, it seemed. The dice had never before signaled a fight. Battles, yes, but never a dust-up in the street. Yet he walked very carefully indeed. Not that that would help, of course. When the dice stopped, they stopped, and that was that. But he saw no reason to take chances. He hated taking chances. Except with gambling, of course, and that was hardly taking a chance for him. He spotted a barrel full of thick quarterstaffs and walking staffs in front of a shop displaying swords and daggers under the watchful eye of a bulky fellow with sunken knuckles, a nose that had been broken more than once, and a thick truncheon hanging at his belt beside the inevitable dagger. The man announced in a rough voice that all the blades on display were Andoran-made, but anybody who did not make his own blades always claimed they were Andoran, or else from the Borderlands. Or Tyran, sometimes. Tyr made good steel. To Matt's surprise and delight, Slim's stave of what appeared to be black yew, more than a foot taller than he was, stood upright in the barrel. Pulling the stave out, he checked the fine, almost braided grain. It was black yew, all right. That braided grain was what gave bows made from it such power, twice what any other wood could give. You could never be sure until you started slicing away the excess, but the stave looked perfect. How in the light had black yew come to be in southern Altara? He was sure it only grew in the Two Rivers. When the proprietor came out, a sleek woman with bright feathered birds embroidered to below her bosom, and began extolling the virtues of her blades, he said, "How much for this black stick, mistress?" She blinked, startled that a man in silken lace wanted a quarterstaff. Slim as it was, she thought the thing was a bloody quarterstaff, and named a price that he paid without bargaining, which made her blink again and frown as if she thought she should have asked more. He would have paid more for the makings of a Two Rivers bow. With the raw bow stave over his shoulder, he walked on, wolfing down the last of the meat pie and wiping his hand on his coat. But he had not come for breakfast or a bow stave any more than for gambling. It was the stables that interested him. Livery stables always had a horse or three for sale, and if the price was right, they would usually sell one that had not been for sale. At least they did when the Seanchan had not snapped them up already. Luckily, the Seanchan presence in Jurador had been fleeting so far. He wandered from stable to stable, examining bays and roans, blue roans and piebalds, duns, sorrels, blacks, whites, grays, and dapples, all mares or geldings. A stallion would not serve his purposes. Not every animal he looked at had a shallow girth or long cannons, yet none matched what he had in mind. Until he entered a narrow stable jammed between a large stone inn called the 12 Salt Wells and a rug maker's shop. He would have thought the racketing looms would have bothered the horses, but they were all quiet, apparently accustomed to the noise. Stalls stretched farther into the block than he had expected, but lanterns hanging from the stall posts gave a fair light away from the doors. The air, speckled with dust from the loft above, smelled of hay and oats and horse dung, but not old dung. Three men with shovels were mucking out stalls. The owner kept his place clean. That meant less chance of disease. Some stables he had walked out of after getting one whiff. The black and white mare was out of her stall on a rope halter while a groom put down fresh straw, and she stood squarely, and with her ears perked forward, showing alertness. About 15 hands tall, she was long in front, with a deep girth that promised endurance, and her legs were perfectly proportioned with short cannons and a good angle to her fetlocks. Her shoulders were well sloped, and her croup dead level with her withers. She had lines as good as Pip's, or even better. More than that, she was a breed he had heard tell of but never thought to see, a razor from Arad Doman. No other breed would have that distinctive coloring. In her coat, black met white in straight lines that could have been sliced by a razor, hence the name. Her presence here was as mystifying as the black yew. He had always heard no Demani would sell a razor to any outlander. He let his eyes sweep past her without lingering, studying the other animals in their stalls. Had the dice inside his head slowed? No, it was his imagination. He was sure they were spinning as hard as they had in Luca's wagon. A wiry man with only a fringe of gray hair remaining came forward, ducking his head over folded hands.
"Toke Fearnum, my lord,"
he introduced himself in rough accents, eyeing the bowstave on Matt's shoulder dubiously. Men who wore silk coats and gold signet rings rarely carried such things.
"How can I be of service? My lord wishes to rent a horse or to buy?"
Embroidery, small bright flowers, covered the shoulders of the vest he wore over a shirt that might have been white once. Matt avoided looking at the flowers at all. The fellow had one of those curved knives at his belt and two long white scars on his leathery face. Old scars. Any fighting he had done lately had not marked him where it showed. "Bye, Master Fearnum, if you have anything for sale. If I can find one that's halfway decent. I've had more spavined glue baits offered to me as 6-year-olds when they were 18, if a day, than I can shake a stick at." He hefted the bowstave slightly with a grin. His da claimed bargaining went better if you could make the other fellow start grinning.
"I have 3 for sale, my lord. None of them spavined," the wiry man replied with another bow and no hint of a grin.
Fearnum gestured.
"One is out of her stall there, 5 years old and prime horse flesh, my lord, and a steel at 10 crowns. Gold," he added blandly.
Matt let his jaw drop.
"For a piebald?
I know the Seanchan have driven prices up, but that's ridiculous."
"Oh, she's not your common piebald, my lord. A razor is what she is. Domani Bloodborne ride razors."
Blood and bloody ashes. So much for catching a bargain.
"So you say, so you say," Matt muttered, lowering one end of the bowstave to the stone floor so he could lean on it.
His hip seldom bothered him any longer, except when he did a lot of walking, but he had done so this morning and he felt twinges. Well, bargain or no, he had to play out the game. There were rules to horse trading. Break them, and you are asking to have your purse emptied out.
"I've never heard of any horse called a razor myself. What else do you have?"
"Only geldings or mares, mind."
"Geldings are all I have for sale except the razor, my lord,"
Fearnum said, emphasizing the word razor a little. Turning toward the back of the stable, he shouted,
"Adela, bring out that big bay what's for sale."
A lanky young woman with a pimply face, in breeches and a plain dark vest, came darting out of the back of the stable to obey. Fearnum had Adela walk the bay, and then a dappled gray on rope leads in the good light near the doors.
Matt had to hand him that. Their confirmation was not bad at all.
But the bay was too big, better than 17 hands, and the gray kept his ears half laid back and tried to bite Adela's hand twice. She was deft with the animals, though, easily evading the bad-tempered gray's lunges. Rejecting the pair of them would have been easy if he had not had his mind set on the razor. A lean, gray-striped tomcat, like a ridge cat in miniature, appeared and sat at Fearnum's feet to lick a bloody gash on his shoulder.
"Rats are worse this year than I ever recall," the stable-keeper muttered, frowning down at the cat. "They fight back more, too. I'm going to have to get another cat, or maybe 2.
He brought himself back to the business at hand.
"Will my lord take a look at my prize, since the others don't suit?"
"I suppose I could look at the piebald, Master Fearnum," Matt said doubtfully, "but not for any 10 crowns.
"In gold," Fearnum said.
"Heard. Walk the razor for the lord here."
He emphasized the breed again. Working the man down would be difficult. Unless he got some help for a change from being Taviran. His luck never helped with anything as straightforward as dickering.
Hurd was the fellow refreshing the straw in the razor's stall, a squat man who had about 3 white hairs left on his head and no teeth in his mouth at all. That was evident when he grinned, which he did while he led the mare in a circle. He clearly liked the animal, and well he should. She walked well, but Matt still inspected her closely. Her teeth, said Fearnum, had been honest enough about her age. Only a fool lied very far about a horse's age unless the buyer was a fool himself, though it was surprising how many sellers thought buyers were all just that. And her ears pricked toward him when he stroked her nose while checking her eyes. They were clear and bright, free of rheum. He felt along her legs without finding any heat or swelling. There was never a hint of a lesion or sore, or of ringworm anywhere on her. He could get his fist easily between her ribcage and her elbow. She would have a long stride, and was barely able to fit his flat hand between her last rib and the point of her hip. She would be hardy, unlikely to strain a tendon if run fast.
"My lord knows his horse flesh, I see."
"That I do, Master Fearnum. And 10 crowns gold is too much, especially for a piebald. Some say they're bad luck, you know.
Not that I believe it. Not as such, or I wouldn't offer at all.
Bad luck? I never heard that, my lord. What do you offer?
I could get Tyran bloodstock for 10 crowns gold. Not the best, true, but still Tyran. I'll give you 10 crowns in silver.
Fearnim threw back his head, laughing uproariously, and when he stopped, they settled down to the dickering. In the end, Matt handed over 5 crowns in gold, along with 4 marks gold and 3 crowns silver, all stamped in Ebudar. There were coins from many countries in the chest under his bed, but foreign coin usually meant finding a banker or money changer to weigh them and work out what they were worth locally. Aside from attracting more notice than he wanted, he would have ended paying more for the animal, maybe even the full 10 crowns gold. Money changers' scales always seemed to work that way. He had not expected to get the man down that far, but from Fearnim's expression, grinning at last, he had never expected to receive so much. It was the best way for horse trading to end, with both sides thinking they had come out ahead. All in all, the day had begun very well, dice or no bloody dice. He should have known it would not last. When he got back to the show at midday, riding the razor bareback because of his aching hip, and with the dice rattling in his head, the line of people was longer than when he had left, waiting to pass beneath the big blue banner, stretched between 2 tall poles that carried the show's name in big red letters. As people dropped their coins into the clear glass pitcher, held by a heavy-set horse handler in a rough woolen coat, to be poured from there into an iron-bound chest under the watchful eyes of another horse handler, who was even larger, more people joined the line, so it never seemed to grow shorter. The thing stretched beyond the end of the rope and around the corner. For a small wonder, no one was pushing or shoving. There were obvious farmers in the line, wearing rough woolens and with dirt ingrained in their hands, though the children's faces, and those of the farm wives at least, had been scrubbed clean. Luca was getting his hoped-for crowd, unfortunately. No chance of convincing him to leave tomorrow now. The dice said something was going to happen, something fateful to Matt Bloody Coffin, but what? There had been times when the dice stopped, and he still had no idea what happened. Just inside the canvas wall, with people streaming past to enjoy the performers lining both sides of the main street, Aludro was taking delivery of 2 wagon loads of barrels in various sizes. Of more than the barrels, it seemed.
"I will show you where to park the wagons," the slender woman told the driver of the lead wagon, a lean man with a jutting jaw.
Aludra's waist-long beaded braids swung as her eyes followed Matt for a moment, but she quickly turned back to the wagon driver.
"The horses you will take to the horse lines afterward, yes?"
Now what had she bought in such quantity? Something for her fireworks, certainly. Every night, soon after dark, so she would catch everyone before they went to bed, she launched her night flowers, 2 or 3 for a town the size of Jurador, or if there were several villages close together. He had had some thoughts on why she wanted a bellfounder, but the only one that seemed to make any sense actually made no sense at all that he could see. He hid the mare on the horse lines. Well, you could not really hide a razor, but a horse was noticed less among horses, and the time was not right yet. The bowstave he left in the wagon he shared with Aginan and Doman, neither of whom was there, then headed for Tuon's faded purple wagon. That was parked not far from Luca's wagon now, though Matt wished it had been left near the storage wagons. Only Luca and his wife knew that Tuon was a high lady rather than a servant who had been about to expose Matt and Aginan to her supposed husband as lovers, but many among the show folk were already wondering why Matt spent more time with Tuon than with Aginan. Wondering and disapproving. They were an oddly prim lot for the most part, even the contortionists. Running off with the wife of a cruel lord was romantic. Canoodling with the lady's maid was sordid. Giving Tuon's wagon this favored spot, among the people who had been with Luca for years and were his most prized performers, was going to cause more talk. In truth, he hesitated about going to Tuon at all with the dice drumming in his head. They had stopped too often in her presence, and he still did not know the why for a single one of those times. Not for certain. Maybe the first time, it had just been meeting her. Thinking of it made the hair on the back of his neck want to stand up. Still, with women, you always had to take chances. With a woman like Tuon, 10 chances a day and never knowing the odds until it was too late. Sometimes he wondered why his luck failed to help him more with women. Women were certainly as unpredictable as any honest dice ever made. None of the Red Arms was on guard outside the wagon. They were beyond that now. So he trotted up the short flight of steps at the back of the wagon and rapped once before pulling the door open and entering. After all, he paid the rent for the thing, and they were hardly likely to be lying around unclothed at this time of day. Anyway, the door had a latch if they needed to keep people out. Mistress Annan was off somewhere, but the interior was still crowded. The narrow table had been let down on ropes from the ceiling, with mismatched plates of bread and olives and cheese laid out on it, along with one of Luca's tall silver wine pitchers, a squat red-striped pitcher, and flower-painted cups. Tuan, a month's growth of tightly curled black hair on her head, sat on the wagon's sole stool at the far end of the table, with Seleucia sitting on one of the beds at her side, and Noel and Ulver on the other bed, elbows on the table. Today, Seleucia was in the dark blue Ebudare dress that displayed her memorable bosom so well, with a flowered scarf tied around her head, but Tuan wore a red dress that seemed to be made entirely of tiny pleats. Light had only bought her the silk yesterday. How had she convinced the show's seamstresses to complete a dress already? He was pretty certain that usually took longer than a day. With liberal promises of his gold, he suspected. Well, if you bought a woman's silk, you had to expect to pay to have it sewn. He had heard that saying as a boy, when he never expected to be able to afford silk, but it was the light's own truth.